Mitch is a chain-smoking, tough-as-nails investigative journalist for the New York City newspaper, The Daily Bugle. Lois Lane is an award-winning, tough-as-nails reporter for the Metropolis newspaper, The Daily Planet. Chris Hoffman is not. He's the guy we got on a podcast. It's time for the Lane Ulrich Report with extra special correspondent, Chris Hoffman.
Hello, everyone. It is Chris Hoffman, your intrepid reporter, reporting in for the Lane Urich Report. Today, I am so excited because we are going to be talking to one of my absolute favorite creators. We're going to be talking to Tim Seeley, famous for his long-running independent comic, Hack Slash, and for working on all of our favorite childhood properties, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Masters of the Universe, also Batman and Robin Eternal. He's got his indie comics, Local Man, which will be coming out soon, which we're going to be talking about. One of my another comic that I was introduced to that is huge fun, Money Shot, and something from my collection here that I always have handy is Tim Seeley's action figure collection. I'm pointing to it at for the people who are going to be watching this on YouTube. And also another, as an indie comic book publisher here in Salt Lake City, Utah, also use this How to Self-Publish Comics, Not Just Create Them. Great book. Highly recommend to anybody who's looking to make their own comics, break into the comic book industry. Has a lot of real-world applicable information in there, so grab that book at your local comic shop. But today, so what we're going to start off with here is Tim Seeley. First off, thank you so much for making the time.
No problem. Happy to talk. I'm in this office by myself all day. You'll hear screaming children downstairs, so it'll be nice to chat with a human.
Nice. Adult, yes, get that.
Adult human, yes.
Yes, yeah. Adult, yeah. I get my older son does school from home too, and so he's like the only person I get to talk to sometimes during the day too. He's wonderful. Do like talking to other people as well.
I've got a 3-year-old and then an 18-month-old down there. That's not mine.
It's my
wife's nanny job. We have children all over the place all the time.
So. Awesome. That sounds like fun. They come and play with your action figures. You have to tell them which ones are for play and which ones stay in the box.
I have sacrificial Masters of the Universe, which I give up knowing that the kids are going to grab them. And then I go, there's the ones. You can have them. And then they leave the other ones alone. So I
Good
never
deal.
Say, you can't touch it. But I do say, how about this one instead?
Yes. Good compromise there. Then it doesn't, it's not the, I don't know. Have you seen Megan yet?
Yes.
Yeah, so like, well, yeah, it's not going to cause the scars like in that movie where she's like, don't play with these ones, the shelf.
Yeah, I don't do that because they are toys and they're meant to be played with.
Yes. So no.
Even the really, I mean, there's Biotron behind me right here.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the 70s. But if my kid says, I want to play with Biotron, I let her play with Biotron. That's just the
nice.
But
that's very cool.
We try to offer something else. But if she insists, that's the deal.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would have like a shelf thing like that would be like an old one like that. Like I don't have a ROM yet, but that is getting to be like a really, really expensive toy because nobody bought it in the first place and it was really fragile.
Right. Yeah. And then now it's never coming back in the form, you know, that we were getting.
Yeah.
So that original, especially in Biotron 2, is like those are they're special that way.
Yeah. No, I hear you. So first thing that we want to talk about, I mentioned Local Man, which is, I believe, an Image book that is going to be coming out real soon. So we're recording this on February 15th. It's coming out on February 22nd. You want to tell people about Local Man, what it's about, and where kind of where you came up with it?
Yeah, Local Man is it's a print-run book. I'm doing an Image Comics with Tony Fleeks, who is the creator, writer of Stray Dog, which is also an Image book. And he also worked on a lot of My Little Pony, so there's our 80s connection. And it's a sort of a crime noir story, but it's also sort of a 90s comic story as well, kind of a homage parody of that, kind of like the Image stuff that came out at the time. It's a flip book, so one story takes place in the modern time, and the other one takes place in the past, in one of the old issues from the 90s. Well, not really from that, but it's the story of a guy who used to be this, you know, sort of celebrity superhero, like a media-friendly superhero team, And all we know is that he's been kicked off the team and he has to go back to his hometown because he has nothing. He lost the rights to everything. He doesn't have his costume. He doesn't have his weapons. He doesn't have any of his – he doesn't have a cool headquarters. He's got nothing. And he's got a bad rep. He can't join another team. So he's sort of stuck in this hometown, and he gets involved in some stuff, as we see in the first issue.
That sounds really cool. What's the so what where'd the idea come from? Is it just like you were deciding to do like a 90s deconstruction there?
Yeah, kind of. It's not even really a deconstruction so much as I was talking to Tony at a convention right before the world shut down, and I probably got COVID at that show because I got really sick and I went home and everybody said it's a flu-like cold, and I was like, okay. But Tony and I had been talking at dinner before the whole world shut down about us. We were sort of into these 90s comics that weren't even the major ones. They weren't even small. I mean, we love that stuff too. But the stuff that we both really liked and we talked about was like the fact that these 90s comics often were just like they were pure potential. It was like someone with an idea and they just want to draw it. And maybe they weren't that good, but they had energy. And so we kind of started talking about that stuff, and it kind of gave me an idea to do something, a story about that kind of thing where, you know, what if you, it kind of crossed over with a fear I have of just like, what if you reach your own potential and that's it, and there's nowhere else to go. And so we kind of combined that affection with this idea, this kind of nightmare of, you know, kind of reaching the end of what you can do. And just having to go back to this life that you kind of felt like you were able to transcend, and make it a story about that. So I had a character I made up when I was 13, right around the time Youngblood came out. He had the very edgy name of Crossjack. And so I picked up that name and redesigned him and brought in a bunch of other characters. And then I combined it with Tony's characters from when he was a teenager. And so we, to give it that authentic feel, we sort of added all this stuff and then kind of came up with this new scenario, which really played off both of our affections for like crime noir, because I did Revival, Tony did Stray Dog. We're both big fans of that kind of story. You know, the neo-noir stuff of the 80s is among my favorite kind of genre. I like as much as I like horror or I like superhero. So, we kind of combined all those things into something I kind of felt like was at least something I'd never seen before.
That's awesome. I love that you're drawing from your childhood, because I think a lot of people who were creators, modern comic book creators, did that back in the day. I know I did. I've got a folder somewhere of characters that I drew that were like sometimes my friends with superpowers and stuff like that. So that's really neat. I'm glad that you guys... Tony, I met him once at a... at the Las Vegas Comic Con, I think, and super nice guy. Like, how's he to work with?
He's great. I remember when I was first introduced to him by our mutual friend Chris Burnham. He said, "You will never find a more solid dude," and that's a compliment of the highest order from a Gen Xer. And so that was something I can honestly say that it's true. Tony's just a really solid guy. You know, he's a great creator. He can do anything. One of the best parts about Local Man is that we both write and draw, which, you know, it's rare for me to work with someone that we both do it, but we just kind of combine it. So we both write the scripts. Tony draws the first part of the story. I draw the second half. We design things. We toss them back and forth. So it's a rare combination of two cartoonists, I guess. I would call a cartoonist someone who writes and draws and does everything. And so we're both those people, and we're able to just kind of have fun with it in a way that I haven't been able to do. There's no sort of stress about, you know, do I have to design this? I can always just kick it over to Tony and he can kick it back to me and we can just sort of make something which is just well considered on all sides, because both of us could do it.
Nice. Well, and it sounds like you're kind of like both on the same like wavelength and vibe of like what you're trying to accomplish. So it's probably a lot easier. There's probably a lot of moments between you two where you're like, I want it to look kind of like this. And then you can talk in code of like this 80s movie, you know, just like this guy, this secondary character, that's who he's supposed to look like. And then you're just on top of it.
Yeah, we have the same reference point. And that's not actually true, you know, of me with a lot of creators, because I do come from a very specific thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a superhero fan, but it's not my, I like superheroes because I like comics. I don't like comics because I like superheroes. So like for me, there's a lot of stuff that sort of I was into that wasn't popular or but it was just because I love comics and I just love the use of the medium. And Tony's like me. That's the, you know, a lot of the stuff that we can refer to is stuff that, like, I know nobody that I else work with knows this stuff. Like, I'd be like, oh, it was like that issue of Nera X or that issue of, you know, that issue of Hero magazine where they did an interview with Rob. And I was like, and he knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's a very specific kind of interest and sort of it's really about comics more so than I think it is even about, you know, superheroes. That's part of it.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know. I love hearing process things. So you mentioned like the different types of comics. So like you're a artist and a writer, and you create comics that are all along the spectrum. You haven't really been like pigeonholed into anything. You do horror comics. You do like mainstream comics. Just Ant-Man and Wasp. I saw that was amazing and very timely with the release of the new movie. Was going to ask you real quick, when do you think Eric O'Grady's going to get his time in the sun in the movies, right, in the MCU?
Well, it's weird. They kind of gave Paul Rudd's version of Scott Lang Eric O'Grady's personality, kind of, because Scott Lang was a thief and he was all those things, but he was kind of more, you know, he wasn't like overtly insulting and kind of a terrible person. And Eric O'Grady was kind of Robert's reboot of that version. And they kind of gave him a combination. So I think it Eric O'Grady be tough because they already kind of, you know, they kind of merged them together. Mm-hmm. Like someone understood very early, like, oh, what makes Ant-Man interesting is if it was somebody who was a good person. So Hank and good at this and it got stolen. Like that's someone realized that early, which was, you know, in the Kevin Feige, I'm sure. And Robert was doing that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just added a new guy. And Eric stole it from Scott, right? So mm-hmm. it was like, you know, it's such a good template for that character.
Right. Pull a little bit more on that thread. I'm interested in your take on this. So you're saying like Eric O'Grady, like I like reading about that character. I don't like him. Like you said, he's a dick, you know, okay. Like he's not a great person, but you hope that the next time he has the opportunity to do the right thing that you root for him. Right. And then no chance. He never does it. You know what I mean? On the next turn, how do you write a character like that? At his core, he's an unlikable person. You know what I mean? Like if you took like his traits and put him on a whiteboard, you'd put him in the bad person category. But like for me, I'm interested in reading about him. How do you write a character like that?
Oh, it's so easy. I mean, that's the thing. I always come back to this because I think one of the worst complaints I hear from comic fans or more likely movie superhero fans are like, Superman's not realistic. Like nobody with his powers. Like, yeah, that's the point. That's the fucking point. He's not like you. He's aspirational, right? And so like that is so much more interesting. Superman is so much more interesting and way harder to write. Like because he can't like sort of motivate his own story. The thing with a character who's a piece of shit is they're easy to motivate because they make their own problems, right? So I always think it's so ridiculous. Like it is so easy to write a guy like Eric O'Grady because he's led by his id. I want money. I want sex. And increasingly that was sort of that character's thing is that he's kind of a huge pervert. And you know, that is such an easy character to write, right? Like, cause it's such an easy motivation and it's also an easy character, I think, for people to like, cause then they don't have to do anything. They don't have to put any effort up to be a better person or to aspire to be a better person. And so that's why Superman is such a better character and also hard to write. And also every time I hear that thing of, you know, it's not realistic. It's like, yeah, that's the problem, and you're the problem, so stop being a piece of shit and try to be somebody better. So there's my hot take on that. But it's easy to write a crappy person. It's so easy. Mm-hmm. Like, for horror stuff, I really think that's important, you know? Like, making Cassie kind of a messed up person is important for a horror story. Because to some degree, she has to motivate her own story, but she also has to be just ahead of the thing she fights, right? That's what makes a horror character interesting, that they that to some degree that they're never that much better than the thing that they're faced with, which, you know, that's why Ash Williams is a great character, or the Invisible Man or Dracula or any of those characters is like, you know, we all understand why they do what they do, but we're kind of standing on the side of what if they go all the way, which is so, that's the interesting part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which superhero characters shouldn't be that, really, right? Like, they should be the opposite. They should be aspirational. Even Spider-Man, you know, like, he has feet of clay. He's got your problems, right? He's got to take care of Aunt May, and he's got to go to work and sell photos to a jerk. But he's always going to choose the right thing, and that's what makes him interesting. You know, the great power responsibility thing is, like, core to that character. So, I don't know. It's a rant, but it's easy to write a piece of shit. It's so easy.
No, that's a good point. I was talking to my co-writer about this, and we were just kind of interested in that. So I'm glad you had a point on that. The Superman point is also really good. There's a lot of times that I find Superman being really good and interesting in other people's stories because he's a contrast to what's going on to something right. else.
Absolutely. Grant Morrison was great using Superman as that for his JLA stuff. Or, you know, Superman kind of comes in at the point of sort of like, we need this great person to look up to, and Superman would always be that, and you'd always get these great moments of Superman being great,
mm-hmm.
and true, and he would fit his character, and it would be and it would also be just an excellent superhero moment. That's the kind of stuff I try to aspire to do with superheroes. But you know, then it's, you just sort of have these people go like, no, Superman would totally kill people. It's like, that, okay, all right, that's Homelander, you fucking weirdo.
Yeah. Yes, and there are lots of like mean Superman stories if you want to read those. Irredeemable is another one that's really interesting to read.
And there's nothing wrong with that, and I think, you know,
sure.
you should explore that. But I think this idea that you can't handle it because of, you know, it's putting too much on you to look up to somebody being better is like, well, that's a societal problem that maybe we should deal with.
Right. That does seem like a societal problem. It seems like if you had Superman. I've said this before at conventions where Superman's origin back in the day was that he, you know, fought for downtrodden people, right? Like, one of his first stories is about destroying a set of projects or destroying some slums so that they could build projects like rent controlled housing for poor people, right? Like, that's what he did.
Absolutely.
And
he was a populist. He was a. Mm-hmm. Progressive populist, yeah.
Yeah. Comics were always political. Like, when people are mad about that, we're like, why are my comics political? It's like, they've always been. Like, you're just not paying attention. Like, people that are surprised they're Rage Against the Machine, what are they raging against?
Yeah, that shit drives me crazy. And it's that thing also, like, maybe when you're younger, you actually were on the side of that, but you got older and you got sort of selfish and conservative, and all of a sudden now you're like, wait, what? Rage Against the Machine? It's like, no, you changed. They didn't change. And Superman didn't change, you changed. That's on you, and you need to deal with that shit, you know, and not expect this character to rise up to your level of pessimism, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I always think that's interesting that the origin of Superman, Jewish immigrants, and doing this character, and, you know, all the sort of creation of these characters, essentially by a lot of Jewish immigrants like John Kirby, you know, like, they're telling a story about immigrants, they're telling stories about being a minority, they're telling stories about people fighting back in the system being bad, but them not giving up their morals to fight the system, like, duh.
Yeah.
it's pretty shocking when you hear someone misunderstand it. You just have to be like, you know, your fandom doesn't get to trounce the facts, the historical facts about these creations. You know?
Yeah. Well, and people are surprised, like people, like you and I grew up with these morality tales, right? Where all of these things, and explicitly Masters of the Universe had like a morality, like, lesson, like at the end of the episode, they told you eat your vegetables, you know, like stand up for people who can't stand up for themselves. I remember there was an episode about gun safety. It was like, you need to be careful with this, you know?
Yeah. Which, and then to look at the origins of those things, you know, Filmation put those on there because at the time they had just deregulated the FCC because of Reagan, who of course, you know, gave us the situation we're in. But part of the thing was that Filmation and Mattel were like, well, look, we might get criticism at some point for making a half-hour commercial for a plastic product, so let's make sure it has value. It's sort of like the comics code. They're like, well, let's put this here. It'll stop us from getting in trouble later. Again, there are episodes where they clearly didn't have much to give you a lesson in. They're just trying to help.
Sure.
But, like, you know, it's kind of a bummer that that was seen as so cheesy. And I thought, you know, it's such a part of this story. Like in Multiverse, the Master of the Multiverse story, that was the whole thing. In the end, we were saved by the cartoon He-Man giving us a lesson. So it has to be part of that story, I think.
What? Yeah, one of my favorite stories. What I was going to say is, like, we got all these morality tales, and like with Star Wars and all that sort of stuff, where it's the little guys fighting against big evil empires and stuff. And then people are surprised that we grow up and we're like, hey, maybe socialism isn't so bad. Maybe we could get a little bit of like universal health care and stuff. And they're like, where did these people learn this stuff? It's like, it was all of our media at the time.
Well, it's funny. Gen X is the Trumpiest generation. So we're actually the most conservative. You and I, that our generation, which is crazy. Because the millennials are kind of in between, but Zoomers are the ones that are like, fuck it, crack the system, don't buy a car, fuck the oil industry. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the ones, and I don't know where they got it from, but I assume it's SpongeBob or something. So,
right. Yeah, all their media is just absolutely nuts. I love it, but yeah, it's absolutely nuts. I'm glad you mentioned the Masters of the Multiverse, because I absolutely love that story. And also because of the action figure collection, this action figure collection kind of felt like your audition for doing these comics, which I actually point to this book when people come to the convention and ask us, like, how do I get to the point where I could write Spider-Man or something like that? And it's like, hey, it's a good chance. Come up with your own thing. You know what I mean? And make it similar. You know what I mean? To make a guy that has a similar power set. And then at some point, if it's popular, someone will come along and be like, oh, you write a thing that's a lot like this other thing. Like, you should just do this then. Make the connections for people.
Yeah, there is really value in... So in the real world, no one will hire you for a thing they haven't seen you do, right? Because in most cases... Not all cases, but in most cases, the people that hire you for things are not imaginative. So they cannot come up with a scenario where you do a thing without them having seen pretty much explicitly that. But I do think, like, yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Colt Noble, the action figure collection, which Colt Noble was like my sort of way to get around. I had made a conscious decision that I was like, I'm not going to try to work on Master of the Universe because it's my hobby. And comics have become my hobby, or become my jobby, and they were my hobby. So, like, I kind of felt like I couldn't, you know, do that. But I had this sort of burning desire to do it. And I had this idea of, like, kind of playing Master of the Universe as sort of like a teen sex comedy, you know, where you get the body of, like, a super muscle dude. What do you do with it? Save the world or hump a lady? And then going back to the sort of Superman story of, you know, bringing in – he's got that moral quandary. And, of course, he's always going to make that side, but he's challenged by it. And then just to make it funny and make up a bunch of characters and stuff. But it did lead to working on Master Universe because people who worked at Mattel had seen it, had read it, and were like, you know, and at a certain point when they're like, hey, you know, if you want to do this, we know you love Master Universe. Everybody knows. You're the guy on the internet. Everybody says, that's the guy. So when it started coming around, like to do the art book and stuff, I was like, I can't turn it down. I would feel stupid to do it, even though I said it wasn't my hobby. So now I have to get a new hobby. there is something there to be said about that. To really, if you love something and you know it's something you get, you know, if you're really lucky, the thing that you love that you understand more than anybody is the Flash or Green Lantern or something like Jeff Johns, right? Or Batman like Scott Snyder. Like the one thing that you love and you understand more than anything makes shit tons of money. That's really lucky. If you can be that guy, who you love, and the voice that you have is something that's very popular, that's great. Mine is He-Man. That's the one thing I get sort of more than anything. So, you know, that was the kind of recognition, too. It's like, well, if Scott loves Batman, he's going to do Batman. And if Jeff loves The Flash and Green Lantern, and he's doing that stuff. And those are his passions. Like, okay, I'm going to give it a go on doing Master Universe, and I'm going to give up that hobby. And hopefully it works out okay. And, you know, it does. It has. I mean, the crazy part is for me is working with Mattel is like, those are the best people I work with. It's crazy to me that, you know, I have such a great experience working with Mattel. So those are the guys that made the toys that like filled my childhood. And I really like working with them. So that's a bit of incredible luck, I guess, for me.
No, it's really cool. Well, it's well deserved, man. So, like a little bit of luck, a little bit, and a lot of hard work there. So, but speaking of, so you've got you do have a new Masters of the Universe book coming out real soon here. The Masters of the Universe, the Masterverse number one. It is a anthology book. It sounds like it's going to be really fun. Why don't you tell everybody about that book so they can get it on their hold real quick?
Yeah. Well, so Masterverse coming out from Dark Horse Comics, who is the current holder of the Masterverse license. Essentially, there's a toy line called Masterverse, which is a sort of unlimited Masterverse toy line, which they just make cool figures of anything. So they can do like, hey, here's a version of He-Man as this. Here's a, you know, a take on Skeletor like this. Here's a Skeletor from the movie. Here's, you know, from this kind of series. And so we wanted to do a series that allowed us that, which is anything goes, any take on the character is accurate and right. And let's just have fun with it. And then Mattel said, Rob David specifically, what if we use this to work with all the artists we ever wanted to get on Master of the Universe? And so right off the bat, the first issue has a story by that I wrote with Kelly Jones on art. So we think it's like horror He-Man story. We also have Sergio Argonis, the legendary cartoonist. We have him doing a sort of humorous kind of, you know, He-Man is a kind of wandering barbarian idiot, similar to Sergio's Gru series. And so this is a series that just allows us to, you know, tell these stories about these. He-Man is an unlimited imagination provider, and then also to work with these legendary cartoonists. And so it's really cool and really fun. And I'm really happy that people are going to read it, because I did this like a year and a half ago or two, maybe. It just took us a really long time to get all the artists together and put it out. So it's out today, and I'm very excited to have people read it.
No, it looks great. I'm excited. That was the first art, like, sample page that I clicked on here was this version of Spidor, very Webster. No, Webster.
Yeah, Webster.
Yeah, what was it? The Webster.
Got it. You're right. Yeah.
And looking horrifying. Yeah, I'm so excited for a horror story of this. I think this is really fun that there's finally a little bit of growing up a little bit of some of our properties, right? Where it is, you can have a horror story that involves He-Man and stuff. It doesn't always have to be marketed to 12-year-olds, right? Or younger now, because like people are going, but there's a little bit for everything, and I've liked that about like because it's taken a while to get to that point. Star Wars never really got to that point where it always felt like that those like the prequels and stuff like that were always for the kids of that generation, right? Where the original Star Wars was for the kids of our generation, and so it yeah, I don't even know what I'm getting at with this. I just think it's like this time it's kind of cool that's happening.
It's the exact opposite of you.
Okay.
And, you know, because it's fun to argue. I think Star Wars will always be a kid's thing. Always. Always. And you can enjoy it as an adult, and it's well made, and so it can be. And that's kind of how I think about Master Universe as well. It is, by design, it's for little kids to pick up this plastic thing and go, I don't know, what's this guy's story? I want to know. I'm going to make one. I'm going to live in this world where there's barbarians and there's lasers and there's, you know, there's ships that look like fucking eagles and whatever. Mm-hmm. And an imagination engine for a kid. But I also think, you know, it's a world of unlimited possibilities, and you can tell these sort of stories in different genres. And again, we're never going to go super hard dark with Master Universe.
Sure.
It should be where it is. But I think the point for this series is look where your imagination could take you when you were a kid. Maybe you went here, let's celebrate it. Maybe you were a kid, you were playing Master Universe, you know, your version of this story, you know, maybe Webstore was the hero. Maybe because you thought he was so cool and you carried him around every day for when you were, you know, going to kindergarten, and you brought this thing. And that's the cool thing about Master Universe. It's about, to some degree, takes, versions. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a story, but one of the best things I think when I was a kid was, you know, the cartoon didn't line up with the comics. Comics were a little bit, especially the mini comics, could be like a little bit more serious, a little darker. It didn't line up with the DC series. It didn't line up with the children's book, the storybooks. And that was okay, because in your head, you kind of understood this is a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important, because I wish comic fans, they didn't grow up that way, right? Mm. They grew up as, this is one thing, and these things are all important. And when it doesn't match, I hate it. Which is the which has caused so many problems, right? Like, people get mad about these, like, you know, incongruities and continuities. And it's like, well, it's still a story. It's made by humans. It is not, you know, it is not a news report from an alternate universe. Like, it's not. So I think there's something cool about, I think, Master Universe allowing that, and always allowing your input, your version, new takes, new imagination possibilities. Like, if we set that up in Masterverse, when you read the horror version and you go, holy crap, you could do a whole story of which He-Man is sort of cursed instead of, you know, and he says by the horror of Greystall instead of by the power. And then you can also have a whole universe where you've got, he's just a goofy wandering barbarian who seems like an idiot, but is actually really clever, right? Like, you could just do that and you could have all of these things and they would all be right. I hope that's what they got of it.
No, this yeah, that seems fantastic. That I'm glad that the licensor is allowing that to kind of go on, because that I feel like there was a lot of times beforehand where if you had a story, they were worried like, oh, is this going to hurt it and not and hurt the toy sales? Is this going to hurt the lunchbox sales and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, and they and not only are Mattel sort of okay with it, they encourage it. You know, they get it in a way, I think. I've never seen with anybody I work for, you know, that they just sort of, and part is, you know, if you look at everybody who now sort of works in toys and stuff, they grew up on this stuff. Rob is my age. He was a He-Man fan. He gets it. He gets that, you know, when he was a kid, this was his version of the story and it's different than mine. And even within my household, my brothers and I had different versions of what was going on here and who was the best character. And that should be what we celebrate, I think.
For sure. Well, since you just brought it up there, who is your favorite Masters of the Universe character? And like, could be like, if it's the character or your favorite toy, which one is it?
I have both. I can say both.
Okay.
My favorite character is Teela. And I always just really liked the idea that she was, you know, well, one, she was hot and I was a kid and I had to like fight to get a girl action figure in the 80s because that was considered kind of weird. But I was like, I don't know. She got shiny brown legs. I like them. And then, but I always liked her as a character. You know, she's kind of conflicted. She's the Lois Lane of the Master Universe story. She's so, like, so competent, and she's got her shit together, but she's kind of stuck between in a romance, you know, triangle between the same guy, right? And then, but my favorite toy is Faker, which is the evil robot copy of He-Man, and it's just a beautiful object. It's, I mean, you know, as far as why, it just makes me ask all these questions. Why is Robot He-Man blue? Why does he have this little sticker on it? But it's just a beautiful item, you know. And I think so much of what works about Master Universe is it's toy first, right? Like, we've got to make these beautiful toys that kids want to play with. And here's our restrictions, and here's the idea, you know, the things we have to get. We have to get an action feature. We have to have something. And so they make these pop art objects that I think that sort of that object transcends even story. I mean, that, you know, is it a huge dramatic story to have an evil He-Man robot that doesn't look like him? Not really, but he's a cool object.
That is really cool. Well, there's the dimension to that too, where it is like, well, the reason that they made this one is because it was cheaper to make, too, because they had the mold already. They just painted it different and then remixed the accessories and sent it back out. And so there's also that, because I remember my dad pointing that out to me when I was a little kid, when I was playing with these. And he was like, that's the same mold. Like, they just made the one mold. And I remember, like, just not helping me with the toys. Like, why are you trying to teach me to be so cynical about this? But yeah, he's like kind of the epitome of that, because they did that with a lot of the figures, right? But he was the one where they were just like, he's just a different color.
Yeah, I guess to me, as someone who, you know, has to work in a art industry, there is something really, I think you can be more creative with restrictions.
Yes.
So, you know, them sitting around a room with a bunch of parts and going, well, what can we make out of this? We can only tool one new head this release, or we can only tool one new armor. And so they're getting creative, and I mean, that sort of limitations, that's the stuff that breeds great art, right? That's Andy Warhol, and that's, you know, all these people were working within a sort of set of imposed restrictions, which I don't know, that to me, it kind of adds to it, doesn't take away from it.
Yeah. Oh, no.
That they had these, you know, they could only get away with so much. And so you see the creativity in it. Like, you know, going back to the, like, the character when they did the releases of, for instance, like Clawful and Buzzoff or so. Or, you know, they're using the claw hand and like, okay, we can use this, but we can't, this one's got a big claw hand, it's got a little one, let's make another claw hand. And let's use this body from Whiplash because it's alligator, but it could be a bee. It's just like all these things. You're like, that's genius. You know, mm-hmm. Or Tinkor, which is, hey, Merman's head is supposed to be a fish, but if you kind of look at it, it could be a cat. It could be a skunk. And then all of a sudden you got this, like, you know, just really creative applications of color. And, you know, and I think it forces those things to be, you know, sculptures that are on their own beautiful objects.
Yeah. No, I love that take. I never thought about it that way before, as like pop culture, like artwork. You hit my favorite one. Stinkor and Mossman were my two favorite figures because it was like they smell gross. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I have versions, a couple of each, and they hold up. Stinkor still smells. Mossman a little bit less, but, you know, they're infused plastic. Like, they put patchouli in plastic, and that just lasts forever. So.
Yeah. No, that is awesome. So I wanted to talk, before we started recording, I said that I noticed something while I was looking through, like, a lot of your body of work here, and that you seem to be in charge of a lot of crossovers in your comics. So you did the G.I. Joe versus Transformers, which is like, I think that's King Kong versus Godzilla level of, like, A-list things that two great tastes that go great together. It seems like those ones, they were just made for a perfect crossover. But you also did a Chucky versus Hack Slash. You did a guest appearance there. Evil Ernie and Ash from The Evil Dead also made appearances in Hack Slash. You did the Tarzan versus Planet of the Apes and Injustice versus Master of the Universe. And so, like, these, and you did a bunch of other ones, that, like the Superman versus Lobo and stuff like that, which were versus books, not necessarily, but the crossover ones I'm talking about are like the different universes, right, where they are similar universes but come together and work on a book. So what do you think, like, is the attraction of those? Because I love crossovers like that so much. I will give it's one of my favorite things. But what do you think is, like, the attractiveness of those? And, like, what's the, what makes a good one? What makes a good crossover?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think about this all the time, because when I was a kid, I remember once going to the comic store, and I mean, I was probably like, I don't know, 14, 13, somewhere in there, and they announced that there was going to be Archie versus the Punisher. And I remember my friends being like, oh, so lame. Oh, so stupid. Like, no, this is amazing. Because if you just take any two characters, right, because it's like the real world, if you grab any two people, you could force them to be together, and they would have a story. That's just how, you know, if situations came up, you know, any two people could end up on a road trip together or whatever. So so it was so weird to me that people didn't think that was cool, and it bothered me for a long time. And but I kind of, when I started working in comics, that same philosophy stuck up. So when stuff would come up, I would be like, yeah, we can make that work. Because to me, the job is to use things that seem disparate or unrelated, to use them to tell us something about each character. That's the job. So, like, it may seem like they're not related, but that's you as a writer. You have to figure out how they're related, right? And then, I mean, this whole thing of, like, we have to figure out how they get in a universe is, like, who cares? But what we do have to figure out is, like, what do they define about each other, you know? And if the characters are well-defined in their own existence, when you put them with something that's seemingly very different, it'll tell you a whole bunch about the character. So what I loved about when I did Archie versus the Punisher, which was, you know, the Punisher doesn't change who he is when he comes into Riverdale, and Archie doesn't change who he is when he stumbles into Punisher's New York. But that's what's interesting, because also Punisher's like, what is this town? I assume everything is gritty and grim, and they're all sitting around the chocolate shop having a malt, and those things that should make the characters who are in it more interesting. We should learn something about them, which, you know, stuff like when, I mean, G.I. Joe Transformers, and especially the ones I wrote, was like, well, let's just take the things that people hate about, that, you know, people don't like Cobra La in G.I. Joe, or they don't like the unrealistic things. Well, let's put that here. Let's put that in this story, and let's exploit the weirdness, and let's play with that part of it. And Injustice versus Master of the Universe was a big part of that. Was, okay, these things seem like they should not relate at all, but there's a key here, which is, if Superman is bad, then what does that make He-Man, right? And that makes He-Man that he's got to stand in for Superman. He's got to be the guy who does the things that an evil Superman doesn't do. Like, that's the story. That's not what this is about. So, I mean, and maybe it's just a naivete or enthusiasm on my part, but I also just think too many people are concerned, you know, that it's somehow silly. And to me, this is all silly, if I'm being honest. Like, it's all silly. And if I don't enjoy that part of it, then what am I doing here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, take the story about the guy who's doesn't wear a shirt and a fur loincloth. I want a serious, dark and gritty Superman or He-Man. Yeah, I don't get that either. There's a point when you get to comic book. I understand the comic book realism, what people want. They don't want things that are like Batman's always the example, right? Where it's like you try to treat him into, you can go too far into realism with him, where it's like it doesn't make sense anymore. It's not fantastic anymore. If it gets depressing at a certain point, right? Where what he's fighting against.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is it comes down to that thing I said before: is these are kids' characters. Superheroes are kids' mm-hmm. characters. All the big two superhero characters are kids' characters. So, to some degree, the problem you always kind of have is that the people that should have moved on in the 80s and read Howard Chaykin's American Flag, they stayed and read Batman, and they demanded Batman age with them. And so now, then we get Frank Miller's stuff, and, you know, it worked as a sales thing, but it sort of pushes out what the character was made for. It's a kid's character. It's a lunchbox. It's an action figure. You know, you pack him in with a parachute, and you throw him, and he floats down. Like, that's Batman. To some degree, there's this shame, I think, that people demand the characters grow with them because they don't want to be seen reading something that's kids' stuff.
Mm.
You know, which then the other side of that is that too often comics are considered kids' stuff, which that's not accurate either. It can contain any medium and anything. And so you should be able to do Howard Chaykin's American Flag, and you should be able to do Money Shot. But you should also be able to do the fact that, you know, Superman and Batman and Spider-Man are for kids. But we're sort of always in that weird... you know, this sort of shame spiral. And, you know, look, there are plenty of great stories about a more adult take on Batman. That's fine. You know, he's flexible. He can do that. But, you know, if you forget any of these things being what they really are, then you end up with this kind of, you know, people who just take things too seriously and they can't have fun. And they are ashamed to be seen with under their arm Archie versus the Punisher, which is like, that shit just really bothers me. It just tells me, like, we haven't, and to this day, we haven't sort of accepted what superhero comics from the big two should be, and we haven't accepted that comics as a medium, it should contain all genres and can be for any age, and we just haven't really moved on from that.
Right. No. Well, and you're speaking of that comics that aren't for kids, I like to point out Money Shot. So, this was the original comic that I had contacted you about, to chat about, because I got a copy of this. Aw, hey. That's one of the things that I am super jealous of, is because I don't know, when we were kids, the things that I had, because I had, I'm from a place of privilege in my childhood, because I was an only child. My best friend, Andy, who would come over and play, came from a family of like six, seven kids. And so when he came over, the first time he came over to my house, I had like all of my He-Man guys like set up by my fireplace. I didn't even know he was coming over. He was from my Cub Scout troop out here. And he came over, and it was like a neighbor kid that couldn't play. And he came over to my house and said, "Can you play?" And I said, "Sure." And I said, "You want to play He-Man?" And he looked over, and it was all of the figures. You know what I mean? He was like, "You are my new best friend. We're still really great friends." But that was what He-Man meant to me. It was like super, like my friendship. But as fun as and cool as those toys were, some of the cool and fun toys that are coming out now, like that Skeletor staff, man, yeah. They got such cool things nowadays that I would have killed for as a kid. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, and they're, you know, the availability of kind of, you know, that you can make stuff for adults and for kids, and So you do get things like objects that we would never have considered possible, huge play sets that, you know, like as a kid, you could, your parents could maybe drop $40 on something, and that was expensive then. And now you got these giant, you know, Master Universe play sets that like take up someone's entire basement.
Yeah.
Could be a golden age if one were inclined to give up their entire, you know, rec rooms too.
Right. And all of their money, because those things are getting so expensive. You have to kind of pick and choose on those. I'm probably going to try to pick up one of the Robatos from the new line. Cause that's a nice figure.
Yeah. Sure. But
I was going to ask you about Money Shot, because this was the first book. So like you said, the comics is a medium. It can be anything. It's not just for kids. It's for anything. And so I think this is another genre of book that it carries a set of shame, like you were talking about, people that they don't want to be seen. As part of my friend group here, we do a book club, and I've been introducing people to a little bit more books with some adult content in it. Money Shot is one of them. Unnatural from Mirka Andolfo was another one. That was a book where my whole friend group was like, we're going to read this. And then they all came back like, this was amazing. You know what I mean? Like, so I think this goes into another, and Money Shot's the same way. So give people like the real quick overview of what Money Shot's about.
Sure. And then, so the story is, in the near future, science is extremely underfunded because no one cares, and the politics of the time are very similar to now. And so a group of scientists make the decision that to fund their interstellar sort of device that they've created, which is extremely expensive to use, they will shoot porn of them banging aliens to fund the project. And so it's a story about exploration and sexuality and the sort of complications that come from sex, but it's also a straight up satire of everything that bugs me at any given time.
Yes. Hilarious. And the idea of like, this would work. You know what I mean? Like, it's so funny how like adult content and new technology are so intertwined. Like new technology, like new communications technology and stuff like that is always pushed to the limits by adult content, right?
Yeah, the whole porn leads innovation thing, which was a big part of, you know, the VHS versus beta thing was decided by porn. DVD versus VHS was decided by porn. And so much of our sort of technological stuff comes from, well, what is porn going to do? But like you said, it's such a big innovator and a driver for that, but it's also this thing we don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, so hypocritical. And so, I, you know, hopefully the story kind of shines a light on all that sort of stuff while, you know, also just being an entertaining comic that's in the tradition of the sort of explorer stuff and challenges the unknown or any of that kind of story, which I love that kind of stuff. I love exploration stuff. But this is that plus lots of weird naked.
Yeah. Great artwork. Wonderful. Doesn't hurt anything on that. And it's the great story of the interpersonal conflicts that are going on between the characters, and like a take on like cultural diversity as well. Like when they're meeting up with these different aliens, what their takes on sexuality is and what it means what it means for society in broader senses and stuff like that. And you can kind of focus a lens on the differences between different cultures without having to be, but it's an alien culture. So you can be like, oh, it's not like it is a foreign culture in that it's an alien, but fascinating, well-written, well-drawn, but it's an adult comic. And so it's another one of those. It has like a weird, I love the way, I feel like there's a connection there where you're like, well, people don't want to be seen reading a comic book that's for kids. Same kind of mirror dimension thing where it's like people don't want to be seen with like, oh, that book is porn, basically, you know what I mean? And it's like, but it's good, you know, it's not the defining characteristic of either thing to say whether it was good or entertaining or not.
I mean, I've always found that really frustrating, and again, like, this is an American thing. It's not the case in most European countries.
Yes,
have more liberal standards. But and then the thing I feel like I always deal this with Money Shot, where people complain on both sides. Wait, this was way dirtier than I thought, or this wasn't as dirty as I thought, which is always like, look, I told you it was a story about porn. It is not porn in itself, right? There is no like we kind of keep it on one side of what the sex scenes show. There is no, you know, graphic anything, because it's about it, but it's not meant to be it itself. And so, like, my most frustrating thing is, like, some Amazon guy's like, oh, I thought this would be hardcore fucking. And it was like, I can't believe this had titties in. It's like, are you fucking? I told you what it was. I don't know why this is so hard to comprehend. And it's America. It's because we can't have something that's in the middle. We can only have one or the other, which is stupidity. But, you know, so I hope the book just sort of, we're just going to keep doing it because it sells. And sooner or later, we break that programming that people have in their heads about what they think about sex. And sex and comics and just things in general, but you know, I'm really proud of the book. It keeps going. We're doing another volume, comes out I believe in April or May. It's called Money Shot Comes Again, and it's with the artist Giselle Ligacci, and it's a continuation of our story with a whole bunch of new stuff thrown in, and I'm really proud of it. It's got a cool crossover character. Speaking of crossovers. Which I won't reveal too much. I'll let you guys read it, but it has a tie back to the history of comics and with adult comics, and it's great. And I'm really happy Vault is letting us do crazy stuff like we do.
That's pretty great. And this is another one of those threads that you can pull in comic book history. There is a long history of sex in comic books, especially in the underground comics, 60s and 70s, and all through the 80s and stuff like that. So, the comics that I always think about are, like Felix the Cat, the Cherry comics.
Well, there you go. That's the you just named our crossover.
No
star.
Way! I was gonna. Oh man, that's so. Well, spoiler alert for those who I love that. I was going to ask if that's what it was. what's the other one from Bizarre Sex?
Omaha the Cat Dancer.
Yeah, Omaha the Cat Dancer. Yep.
I love that one. And I think a lot of these books they used their position as being sort of outside books, you know, as a way to tell a story that was also very political, and they could do things that maybe. Other people would be scared to say. So there's so much great cultural commentary in Cherry, which you wouldn't expect. And,
yep.
And also in Omaha the Cat Dancer. So, it's part of our history, and I want to make sure I salute it.
Certainly. Well, I think Money Shot is up there with those comics where it is the way that my friends who don't usually read that sort of stuff said, it's like, well, better than it kind of deserves to be. And it was like, or that you'd think where it is. And it's, and like you're saying, like it's changing attitudes. It's changing minds about it, because it's like, that was a preconception that they had. That was from the dictionary definition, that was a prejudice they had. They had judged this thing before they had gotten to it. And these are comic book fans. They're the people who at our local comic convention here in Salt Lake, the Fanex, they are the leaders of most of the panels that are here on comic book history and that sort of stuff. And there was, and there's this like kind of blind spot here where it was like, oh, this is because I kind of wrote it off. And so introducing them with these types of stories, and Money Shot helps out with that. And I think you're right. I think it will help with a lot of people understanding that this is part of the genre.
Backing it and you know, putting it in front of people who may have harshly judged us and not, you know, and that is a thing my entire life I've had to deal with, which, oh, this slasher comic was surprisingly good, or this porn comic was surprisingly, why? Why
is it? Yeah. What's the qualifier?
Fine quality. That's so weird. I don't understand. I never have understood it. I don't get it. Things should be judged on the merits of themselves and not, I never have that kind of preconception about things. So, you know, but hey, we'll keep doing the work, and we'll make sure people connect.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. Yeah. And once again, I always tell people, like, if you don't like comic books, that just means you haven't found the one that you like yet. And the thing is, if you don't like a Tim Seeley book, you will find one. You know what I mean? You have done so many books. There is nothing. If you hit through, I had a hard time finding a comprehensive updated list because there's just so much. And there's a couple of websites who used to keep up on that sort of stuff who've just decided they're not going to anymore.
Yeah. The Internet Comic Book Database. I remember I used to use that all the time for myself. I would like connect to it for my resume. I was like, oh, it's gone, because I just got sick of adding every new Alan Davis comic and every new Cullen Bunn comic and every new Meeb comic.
Yes.
Like, fuck, I'm done.
Yeah, anything that Aubrey Sitterson had been the editor on, you know what I mean? It was just like so many books. But yeah, Comic Vine was one that I used to look at, but it looks like they just kind of like stopped one day where they're like, we're just not updating this anymore because it's a pain in the ass. Yeah. But anyway, that is going to be our time. You know what? Thank you so much for accommodating me and getting the time here. And this has been a fascinating chat. We didn't get to like half of the stuff that I wanted to ask. So hopefully we'll have you back in a few months and chat about whatever, you know, like the 800 new comics you've had from then and from now until then, because you always got a bunch of them coming out.
Yeah, if I don't fall over dead from exhaustion, yes.
Exactly. But will you let people know where they can follow so that they find out when the new comics come out?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Hackin' Tim Seeley. I'm also on Instagram at Tim Seeley. I post a lot of my drawings and art stuff there, so and less opinion, so if that's your inclination, you can check it out there. That's mostly my my internet connection. I also have, you can find my website at timseeleycreative.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much for the time. And that is it for the Lane Yurick Report on the world's greatest comic book podcast. Make sure that you like and subscribe. Hit all of the share this show with your friends if you liked it, and keep it to yourself if you didn't. Awesome. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
All right. Thanks, man.